even, I mean, places in not located in Shia heartlands, some pieces of lands carry the name Karbala because of
are
having received
with, yes.
some soils from Karbala.
And they are blessed.
Yes,
they're blessed. But a Shia child is born, we can't say his mouse is blessed with the soil of Karbala, the land.
The headlines: Ayatollah Khamenei says former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein imposed the 1980s war on Iran after getting the green light from the West. The Russian president announces a partial mobilization for the military campaign in Ukraine and accuses the West of engaging in nuclear blackmail against Moscow. And a new investigation uncovers further evidence that the death of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh at the hands of Israeli forces was deliberate. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says major world powers tried to topple the Islamic Republic by supporting former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in his war against Iran. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the remarks on the occasion of Iran's Sacred Defense Week. He said that world powers at the time could not tolerate a new independent country. That's why they decided to wage a war on Iran through a power-thirsty man who was at the helm in neighboring Iraq. He noted that Iranians, however, managed to upend the enemy's plots through their resistance. The leader said even though war is a bitter experience, Iranians were able to turn that threat into new opportunities by emboldening the domestic military defense capabilities. Iraq waged an 8-year war against Iran only a year after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. During the war, Iraq was fully supported by the U.S. and its allies, while the same countries denied Iran access to foreign arms. Iran's president says it will not be possible to reach an agreement on reviving the 2015 deal without closing Tehran's case at the International Atomic Energy Agency. Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks at a meeting with French President Emmanuel Macron on the sidelines of the 77th UN General Assembly in New York. Raisi said the IAEA has officially acknowledged 15 times that Iran's activities are fully consistent with its commitments. He also told Macron that the European signatories need to prove that their policies are independent of the U.S. The Iranian president also discussed the nuclear issue in a separate meeting with Swiss President Ignacio Cassis. He said it's reasonable for Tehran to demand guarantees for a durable deal, given the history of Washington's behavior and how it left the deal. Back in 2018, Washington unilaterally withdrew from the multilateral agreement on Iran's nuclear program and reimposed illegal sanctions on Tehran.
The 77th United Nations General Assembly has opened, with the UN Secretary General warning of a winter of discontent as many Western nations are economically reeling from the backfiring of their sanctions on Russia. Iranian President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi will give his first address to the UN on September 21st, with a focus on creating a more just world through economic multilateralism. Raisi met with French President Emmanuel Macron and top leaders of the European Union, but amid what Iranian delegates described as a very tense atmosphere. France and the other Western signatories have failed for years to adhere to the 2015 Landmark Agreement, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Raisi told Macron that Europe needs to show that its foreign policies are guided by the sovereign interests of their citizens and actually separate from the demands of Washington. This week, Raisi will hold bilateral meetings with the heads of Iraq, Pakistan, Japan, and more than a half dozen other nations, as well as with representatives of a large Iranian-American community, a group estimated to be well over 2 million people. Raisi stressed that Iran is willing to reach a, quote, fair and stable agreement to revive the 2015 deal, but that Iran needs to receive reassuring guarantees that the U.S. will not withdraw from the accord, as it did in May 2018.
Ramin Mazahiri, New York City.
We were earlier joined by journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas. He discussed the recent comments by Iran's president about the JCPOA. Let's take a listen.
It seems that about a year ago in particular, the IAEA, under the Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi, has leaned increasingly towards an Israeli stance. I mean, Grossi actually visited Israel as well. And let's not forget that this is the same Mr. Grossi who heads the IAEA that is meant to bring Israel to the table in terms of its nuclear violations, essentially. 400 nuclear weapons, a pretty good violation by any measure, given that the Israelis don't even want to come onto the table of any kind of non-nuclear nuclear proliferation agreements. They don't want to be inspected by the IAEA. Yet here was Mr. Grossi going off to Israel to take his orders. Many would allege that he actually is in cahoots with the Israeli agenda on the JCPOA. And of course, we know that Israel does not want the JCPOA to go ahead. And I think to consider the IAEA now as some sort of independent outfit, if it was ever going to be an independent outfit, well, certainly it's lost all credibility in the eyes of anybody who looks on neutrally. You know, he's also made some really strange statements.
Elsewhere, President Vladimir Putin is warning the West that Russia would use all available means to respond to threats against its territorial integrity. Putin is accusing Western countries of engaging in nuclear blackmail and trying to destroy Russia. He says Moscow has enough weapons to respond, insisting that this is not just a bluff. Speaking during a televised speech, Putin also ordered Russia's first mobilization since World War II. That announcement drew an immediate reaction from Ukraine, which said the decision shows the conflict is not going according to Moscow's plan. The UK has also reacted, with its foreign minister saying Putin's threats must be taken seriously. The Russian president also said the purpose of the military operation in Ukraine is to liberate the Donbas region. He said most people in the region don't want to return to what he called the yoke of Ukraine. And Italy's elections are 5 days away. Opinion polls show the leader of far-right Brothers of Italy party is a leading candidate to replace outgoing Prime Minister Mario Draghi. Max Civili reports from Rome.
Italy is bracing itself for fresh elections on September 25 after the government of national unity led by Mario Draghi collapsed at the end of July. The former president of the European Central Bank and Goldman Sachs managing director Draghi had lost support of the once anti-establishment five-star movement, the League and Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia. These three parties failed to back him in a confidence vote on his leadership, triggering a government crisis that ended with President Sergio Mattarella calling for snap elections. This will be the first time the Italians go to the polls in September in the country's Republican history.
There is a strong disaffection with politics in Italy, but while in the elections held 5 years ago, the five-star movement was able to intercept people's anger and dissatisfaction. This time, there doesn't seem to be a party strong enough to do the same.
According to final polls, a right-wing coalition is on course to win a comfortable majority of seats in both houses of the parliament, with the far-right Brothers of Italy party likely to win about 25% of the vote. Its leader, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni, could be Italy's next prime minister, the Italian media have reported. Her party took around 4% of votes in the last election in 2018.
I don't have faith in establishment politics, but I don't know who to vote for. At the same time, I think not voting could be even worse. I'm really undecided.
The truth is that I don't have much trust in politicians. Will they be able to keep their electoral pledges?
A few days ago, the US government warned that Russian cash had been funneled to Italian parties sympathetic to the Kremlin without specifying which groups had been the recipients of the funds. Some analysts have seen the U.S. move as a warning to those parties which had expressed sympathy for Russian President Vladimir Putin over the past years.
I think the cabinet secretary with the security brief has already made clear that no Italian politicians nor political parties have received funding from Moscow. If Russia has meddled in elections held in foreign countries, it goes without saying the U.S. certainly did the same.
Over 51 million Italians are entitled to vote at the weekend. Sunday's elections will be held amid general disaffection and political discredit. Recent surveys have shown that some 35% of the Italians won't show up at the polls, a trend that, if confirmed, could put turnout at a record low. Max Civili, Rome.
New evidence shows that Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh was intentionally targeted and killed by an Israeli soldier, despite the regime's claim that it was an accident. A London-based research group and a Palestinian rights group have conducted a fresh investigation into the controversial case. They say the sniper's precise angle of the fire shows the Israeli soldier was clearly able to tell that there were journalists around. The sniper first shot twice to kill Abu Akleh and then proceeded to open fire on those who tried to rescue her. The Palestinian journalist was killed 4 months ago while covering an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Israel has acknowledged that Israeli fire probably killed Abu Akleh, but denies allegations that a soldier intentionally targeted her. Abu Akleh's family has submitted an official complaint to the International Criminal Court demanding justice for her killing. U.S. forces illegally stationed in Syria continue to plunder its natural resources, shipping more oil out of the country. Syrian media reports suggest that the American troops looted 60 oil tankers and smuggled them out of the Hasakah province into U.S. bases in neighboring Iraq. Earlier this week, the U.S. troops sent a convoy of over 80 trucks, including tens of tankers carrying stolen Syrian oil, to Iraq via the illegal border crossings of Al-Mahmoudiya and Al-Walid. American forces are deployed in Syria without any authorization from Damascus or a U.N. mandate. Former President Donald Trump admitted on several occasions that American forces were in the country for its oil wealth. Damascus says the U.S. and its allied militants have pillaged over 80% of Syria's daily crude production in the first half of 2022. And a ceremony has been held in the Syrian capital to honor journalists who lost their lives during the years-long war in the Arab country. Muhammad Ali reports from Damascus.
Syria's Ministry of Information organized an event to pay tribute to journalists who were killed while covering the war on the country. Syrian officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, technicians, and other workers in the media sector.
The martyrs of media are the true heroes on battlefields alongside the Syrian Arab Army. They will remain alive in our memory. Meeting their families is a great honor because they represent truly an example of strength and loyalty to the homeland. We are honoring them today to thank them for their great sacrifices.
Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation expressing how proud they are that their family members' blood was one of the main reasons for Syria's victory over terrorism.
This event means a lot to me. When I receive a call on an honoring, I feel that my son is still remembered and even still around. This homeland requires us to sacrifice. Without sacrifice, we would have no future.
My son was a war correspondent. He was martyred near Kenitra. He was my only son. He sacrificed his blood for the country. The enemy and its media outlets were strong and working to weaken Syria. But thanks to the sacrifices of Syrians, we triumphed.
Press TV's correspondent Maya Nasser was also among the list of journalists who lost their lives during the Syrian conflict. He was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He is one of many journalists who was keen on always being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. Despite knowing the dangers of reporting on battlefields, many journalists risk their lives to report on the truth of events. Tens were killed or injured, defending the principles of journalism and showing responsibility in conveying what was truly happening on the ground in the face of a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Less than 2 weeks to Brazil's presidential elections, former President Lula da Silva is widening his lead against incumbent Jair Bolsonaro.
According to the opinion poll, the leftist foreign president now has a 10% lead over Bolsonaro. That indicates a 2-point increase from last week. Lula is backed by 44% of the voters, while Bolsonaro maintains a 34% support. The survey expects a runoff in which Lula would win 50% of the ballots. President Bolsonaro has seen his popularity drop due to his controversial management of the coronavirus pandemic and the economy. He's planning to retire from politics if he fails to win the upcoming vote.
Lula has returned to the southern region of Brazil, holding massive back-to-back campaign rallies with reinforced security. It was in this region that in 2018, Lula suffered an armed attack on his caravan, the same year he was imprisoned for 580 days in Curitiba. Workers' Party President Gleisi Hoffmann became emotional, reflecting back on the year when Lula was jailed in a move to bar his candidacy.
Esse é o seu retorno a Curitiba, Presidente Lula, no braço do povo.
This is your return to Curitiba, President Lula, in the arms of the people. It is redemption. It is the victory of our struggle over 580 days of injustice and over your persecution.
Polls show that the region continues to be a stronghold for Jair Bolsonaro. However, the incumbent faces fierce opposition, mainly as a result of what is perceived as Bolsonaro's failed policies.
O pior problema é que a fome voltou, né?
The worst problem is that hunger is back. You have more than 30 million people suffering from hunger. All the political and public advances that were made for the people are being taken away. People are not able to retire anymore. They want to starve people to death.
Our country needs to rebuild its democracy, rebuild its nation, its unity, and its political democracy by respecting its diverse institutions. With the current government, our country became a worldwide mockery, a joke worldwide. It became a country disregarded by the main international political alliances.
Now, with just 2 weeks remaining, the slogan out here is Lula in just one round. Camila Escalante in Curitiba.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you.
Iran is no stranger to the handwoven carpet market. Traditionally, the country has been weaving carpets for millennia with skills passed down through generations, some even as highly protected family secrets. Iranians were among the pioneers of weaving carpets, and with years of experience, they have achieved a great deal of perfection in this arena. The craft has represented Iran's rich culture and heritage for centuries and has been adored all over the world. Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. Today we are going to explore Iran's handwoven carpet market. We wanted to see why these carpets are highly coveted and what makes them so expensive. Plus, we will look at some of this sector's contributions to Iranian culture and the national economy. So, stay with us and let's roll out the show. Our quest for answers led us to the 29th International Exhibition of Handmade Iranian Carpets. This event is viewed by many industry participants as the world's largest handmade carpet expo when it comes to quantity and quality. Visitors were dazzled by thousands of handwoven carpets in all sorts of contemporary and traditional design patterns. The exhibition is a place for national and international trade and commercial envoys to visit in order to size up the market and make business deals. All sorts of carpets are found here that were brought in from all corners of Iran, including very rare rugs. We caught up with a few vendors to see what type of activities they carry out. A high-quality Iranian carpet can cost thousands of dollars, with antique rugs fetching even higher prices. There is so much variety to choose from the floral designs of Isfahan to the intricate fine details of Qom carpets and the strong compact Bijar rugs made in western Kurdish villages. The list goes on and on. However, most carpets are not valued based on knot count, but rather because of their materials, design, and overall size. While some rug varieties follow specific designs, most are entirely improvised, with the weaver adding traditional motifs and their personal design touch to the carpet. Handwoven with the finest materials, including wool and silk, a single Persian rug can often take years and sometimes decades to create. Most handwoven carpets are produced in rural areas. Furthermore, women make up the majority of carpet weavers and produce raw materials such as silk and wool in rural areas. Such collectives safeguard the rights and income of weavers who frequently receive the least profit from their products. This is mainly due to numerous middlemen businesses that make money from carpets. Cooperatives also serve another purpose. They organize the production chain by linking material producers with weavers and buyers to complete a production cycle. The massive exhibition is one of the best places to get a bird's eye view of this thriving market. Yes, ironically, one of the biggest importers of Iranian handmade carpets used to be the United States. This is followed by European countries. However, owing to the U.S.-imposed sanctions, Americans were forced to find alternate avenues to satisfy their cravings for these highly coveted carpets. For centuries, the Iranian carpet has represented the country's rich culture and art. Its stunning design and exquisite quality have turned the ancient craft into a lucrative commodity sought after by many across the world. But Iran's handwoven carpet exports have also seen numerous ups and downs over the decades. Industry participants say the U.S. sanctions tried to pull the rug out from under the Persian carpet legacy. But the move didn't work and only seems to have increased the world's demand for these items. 1994 was the golden period for Iranian handwoven carpet exports. Back then, exports peaked at over $2 billion. Later down the road, the U.S. imposed a ban on Persian rugs in 2010. After signing a 2015 nuclear deal, the ban was lifted only to be reimposed after Washington unilaterally pulled out of the accord in 2018. That's also around the time when cheap knockoffs of Persian rugs made by Asian countries began flooding the market. Either way, authentic, hand-woven rugs from Iran still hold their place in the market despite roller coaster exports. The industry is gradually bouncing back. According to Iran's Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture, the country still maintains first place in exports of hand-woven carpets worldwide. Based on figures from the National Customs Administration, exports of hand-woven carpets increased to nearly 85% in terms of value in the first 2 months of 2021 alone. According to the National Carpet Center of Iran, last year the country exported some $64 million worth of these items. Also, production went up after the coronavirus pandemic as many craftspeople who had left the sector returned, causing a production jump of around 400%. No matter where you're from or who you are, one thing that brings people together is a good meal. Everyone has a favorite food. It's a great way to connect with others, experience culture, and explore new flavors. And the food industry caters to our tastes, which is the main driver for the expansion of this sector. The food industry is made up of a complex network of activities related to farming, production, supply, and a host of services and products. So it's no surprise that this sector also plays a significant role in the economic development of any nation. We wanted to learn more about the journey meat products take to finally reach grocery store shelves and dinner tables. So to become more familiar with food production, we visited a meatpacking business on the outskirts of the capital, Tehran. This particular producer was established 15 years ago and has become a familiar name in the industry. The meatpacking market is composed of many sectors within the market. One of the primary concerns for any company packaging meat is the ability to deliver fresh products to consumers. This can happen in various ways and is heavily dependent on the type of meat that will be packaged. For example, this company has several production halls dedicated explicitly to particular activities, because not all meat comes in the same size or can be handled with the same machine. There are different production halls for each meat type. Red meats, such as lamb and cow, require larger machines and more space, while poultry, such as chicken, require smaller machines comprising closed-circuit production lines. But why does this company use a closed-circuit production line? This ensures the meat passing through each stage is kept cool and free of foreign contaminants. More importantly, such a process guarantees that each item is uniformly cut and packaged while maintaining sanitary conditions crucial for quality and safety. Now, the modern food industry uses a wide variety of sophisticated technologies, making production more efficient. It has also reduced menial human labor, freeing up hands for other, more complex tasks. In case you didn't know, and many don't, Iran has indigenized a lot of technology and machinery needed in the food industry. Moreover, these machines play a crucial role in maintaining food quality and safety. For most companies in the food industry, the high quality output is deeply hinged on the raw material they use. In the case of this company, they use free-range livestock that is pasture-fed from some of the most famous animal-rearing regions of the country. While most meat-packing companies have their own slaughterhouses, this one maintains contracts with livestock farmers who slaughter the animals before sending them to the packing company. The food industry is one of the most heavily regulated sectors in the nation. That is because quality and safety are important aspects for consumers. This company makes its products along the lines of Iran's Food and Drug Administration guidelines and the National Standards Bureau. It has also received international certificates for production and safety, meaning it can easily export its products too. Additionally, this company has created numerous job opportunities for the community while maintaining the highest production standards. What makes a company stand out among others in this highly competitive industry is not only the quality of products, but also the services it provides to its consumers. While the food industry has not been directly sanctioned by the United States, These harsh measures have hindered international banking and money transfers. This means many in this sector cannot import important machine components, which are still not locally manufactured.
The basis of the food industry has always been agricultural production. Without the output of this sector, the food industry would not thrive as it does now. That's why Iran has a very robust agrarian industry. But agriculture is not limited to farming alone. It also includes livestock rearing, dairy, beekeeping, aquaculture, and so much more. Plus, exports from this strategic industry have also generated millions in foreign revenues, contributing to the national economy.
First, let's look at the country's meat production as a whole. Based on the National Livestock Exporters Assembly, domestic needs for red meat roughly stands at 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, the country had 72 million heads of these animals, meaning 12 million were surplus and could be used for various exports. According to official figures, this year, 51,000 tons of red meat were produced up to the month of May alone. However, not all livestock are raised for their meat. They are also used for dairy production. Looking at statistics from Iran's Customs Administration, roughly $800 million of raw milk is exported annually. Next, we have the agriculture sector, which mainly produces raw materials for other food production. Data from the Customs Administration shows that some 7 million tons of agricultural and food products were exported last year. This amount was worth nearly $5 billion and reveals an 8% growth in export values compared to 2020. Looking more closely at these exports, around half of this revenue was raked in by 10 major agricultural products. The undisputed king of all agricultural exports is saffron, which brought $1 billion in trade. Next came pistachios, valued at $540 million, followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of value.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here for the first time on Bazaar. The process that we are checking out today is called plating. Well, it's not actually called plating, it's just very similar to plating. I just thought that that's the name that you had heard. It's actually called PVD, or physical vapor deposition. But it's similar to plating in that it's essentially adding a layer of metal on a material, maybe to harden it, maybe to for decorative purposes, but mostly for decorative purposes. So this is the process that we're checking out today in this edition of Bazaar.
The company we're checking out today started their journey by producing microelectronic parts, such as vacuum pumps, vacuum tubes, pressure sensors, and the likes, but they quickly realized that a better way to implement the tools that they're manufacturing is to actually use the parts to assemble a machine to do coating in a much more sophisticated way rather than selling the individual parts. They found a much better market making those machines and getting clients to coat various objects and materials in their machines, or even selling the machine itself to clients so they can run a coating business themselves.
So the application can be used in tiles and ceramics, faucets and other kitchen and bathroom appliances, kitchen utensils, bowls, also kitchen utensils, and decorative items such as these three vases and also crystal. Now, the different colors are achieved using different combinations of titanium. If it's a combination of titanium with nitrogen in the form of a gas, you get the gold-looking color, which is applied on crystal, has this kind of matte texture to it. And the rose gold color is a combination of titanium, nitrogen, as well as aluminum. And the black one, well, the shiny black one, is a titanium, nitrogen, aluminum, and carbon. So, and of course, the last one, the crystal, which has this like tint of rose gold, it is achieved using a completely different material, chromium. But now let's talk about the some of the processes that went behind to get this company to this place that they're able to make these items.
Here's how the process works. Once the objects we want to coat are loaded into the chamber, blocks of titanium are loaded onto the cathodes. The anode is the entire chamber itself. Through small holes in a pipe inside the chamber, argon, a neutral gas, is injected. Argon is the preferred gas for the process because it doesn't chemically react with either our titanium block or the loaded material. At this point, the chamber is turned into a vacuum chamber to allow for the gas to flow more easily in it. The argon is ionized, so it moves towards the cathodes that have the block of titanium on them. And it moves at such a speed that it vaporizes the titanium. And now the titanium in the gaseous form is ready and primed to sit on our material in the chamber, especially since the particles of the material have expanded due to high temperature in the chamber, making it easy for the titanium atoms to go and sit in between the particles and stick to it easily after they've been taken out of the chamber at room temperature after cooling down.
When you see the zapping, that's when the titanium atoms are sticking to the surface of the chair, or when the coating is happening. I'm sorry, it's the physical deposition of the vapors, as the technical term suggests. But there is one missing link here. So what we put in the chairs that we put inside the chamber, they had a silver, an unappealing silver tint to them. And now when they're going to come out, they're going to have a gold coating on them. But here's the thing, the missing link is that the titanium block can only give you a silver shine, right? But the gold shine is not just with the titanium block. If you want to get the gold shine out of it, you're going to have to add nitrogen into the mix too. So through the same pipe that the argon is injected into the chamber, nitrogen in the form of gaseous is also injected into the chamber. And that nitrogen, once it is connected, once it reacts with the titanium, you get that gold tint. And now they're going to open up the chamber. So they were waiting for the air pressure to come back to a stable level because there was vacuum in there. And if they just open up the chamber when there's vacuum in it, that's not going to be good. So there's the gold tint on your silver chairs. And the gold, of course, is the combination of titanium and nitrogen. There you go.
In every part of the world, decor takes a different shape. What people spend money on to make their houses look good is different. Gold has always had a special place in Iran, which makes it understandable that we, perhaps more than the average person in a lot of other countries, would like to have ornaments that have that shine, just without breaking the bank.
Us humans love shiny things. We tend to value them more highly than their non-shiny counterparts. But, you know, gold tends to be a little bit more expensive than, titanium or pretty much any other metal. So because we can't have something this big that is made out of actual gold that shines, we do the next best thing. We coat it in gold, aka titanium and nitrogen. Personally, though, I prefer things to be more matte, but that's just personal preference. But obviously, there's a market for these shiny ornaments and furniture and candlesticks. So whether it's a gold shine or a silver shine that you're looking for, I think now you have a much better idea of where these things get their shine from. But anyways, thank you for staying tuned for another edition of The Bazaar. We're getting close to the end of the program, but before we go, let's take a look at some news and trends in the country's carpet and textile industry. Persian handwoven carpets are some of the world's oldest and most valuable rugs, but watch out, there are scores of counterfeit ones too. That's why these carpets are registered with the World Intellectual Property Organization. The head of the National Carpet Center, Farahnaz Rafe, says Iran's handwoven carpets are registered with the WIPO badge. Rafe describes the global registration for handwoven carpets as a move towards preserving and protecting this original art industry. These rugs will now be exported with the WIPO badge. Also, other ways to spot an authentic Persian carpet are through its handwoven knots, which are tighter and more delicate.
Another method of identifying authenticity is the choice of materials like wool and silk used in the carpet or by pinning down its regional design.
In other news, Iranian artisans have hand-woven a unique rug in anticipation of the famous FIFA World Cup event this year hosted by Qatar.
The carpet's intricate design incorporates flags of participating World Cup teams and top figures from the world of football, as well as information about Qatar. The master weavers are two brothers from the city of Tabriz. They say they used 70% silk and the remaining a combination of wool and silk. The carpet was created with over 2 million knots, measuring roughly 2 square meters, and was woven in 34 months. The work of art was unveiled during a ceremony in Qatar's capital city, Doha, earlier in the summer. It will be displayed throughout the competition for all to see this October.
Carpets can be breeding grounds for all sorts of unwanted allergens. So, Iranian scientists have created a special nano antibacterial coating for carpet fibers, which has become quite popular recently.
These carpets use a material containing silver nanoparticles, which can kill over 600 types of bacterial species. The antimicrobial protection prevents the growth of mold, dust mites, and other allergens. Originally, these types of carpets were released into the market roughly 3 years ago and are currently exported. In 2019, exports of antibacterial carpets stood at $2 million. These items are mainly sent to neighboring countries, Russia, South Africa, and some in Europe.
That covers our program for today. Thanks for tuning in this week. It's bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program Keys of Life, مفاتيح الحياة. I am your host, Abdullah Al-Musawi. We are talking about the second key to life, which is to learn. When it comes to learning, there are adequates that we need to maintain when it comes to learn. So there are manners when it comes to food. There are manners to greeting people. When it comes to learning, it's also there are manners that we need to observe when it comes to learning. First of which, we need to take knowledge in from the right places and the right people. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, he says, طَلَبُ الْعِلْمِ فَرِيضَةٌ عَلَىٰ كُلِّ مُسْلِمٍ. Seeking knowledge is actually compulsory upon every Muslim. That's one. Then he says, فَطْلُبُوهُ مِنْ مَظَانِّهِ. Seek knowledge from the right places. وَاقْتَبِسُوهُ مِنْ أَهْلِهِ. And take it from the right people. Because it's a place that teaches, because it's a person that teaches, it doesn't make them qualified. It doesn't make it the right place to study. We have many Islamic schools in the Muslim world, but what they teach is very destructive. They think they are teaching Islam and theology, but what they teach is they teach people to put a vest on their chests and go to other parts of the Muslim world and blow themselves up, thinking that they will go to heaven. Now, that's a place I should avoid, and those are the people I need to avoid. So when it comes to seeking knowledge, the first thing I must do is to make sure that I go to the right place that teaches the right things, that has the appropriate qualified instructors and teachers, not anyone, because that definitely will misguide me. Any person that has a way of talking could misguide me easily. And the hadith from the Ahl Bayt says, whoever listens to a speaker, if the speaker speaks about Allah, obviously correctly, he is as if he's listening to Allah. And if he listens to a person who deviates people from Allah, he is as good as listening to the shaitan. So me and you, we have to be very, very careful. From the will that being given by Dhul Qarnayn, he says, لا تتعلم العلم ممن لم ينتفع به. Do not seek knowledge from those who they themselves do not benefit from. فإنما لم ينفعه علمه لا ينفعك. For he who his knowledge does not benefit him is not going to benefit you. We see a lot of people, a lot of speakers, a lot of preachers. They talk about do this and do that, this is good, this is that. But they themselves do not practice what they preach. These people we should avoid, because if this knowledge did not benefit it themselves, how will it benefit me and you? So we need to go to a person who is knowledgeable and at the same time, عامل, عالم وعامل. He knows and he practices. Those are the people that what they teach me will have an effect on me. It will make a change in my life. Even when the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi, he was asked to instruct a child not to eat dates, he had to stop eating dates for a while. Then he instructed the child not to eat dates. He said, well, first I need to apply before I preach. Let us take a short break, then we continue right after.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book مفاتيح الحياة, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafati, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in the Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Keys of Life, Mafatihul Hayat. So when we talk about the etiquettes and the manners of learning, we said one, first, we have to make sure we take it from the right places, the right people, the right sources. Two, when it comes to learning, one needs to have patience and perseverance because knowledge does not come easy. There are things need to be done. I need to wake up in the morning, for example. I need to go far places. I need to take transport. I need money. I need a lot of things. So there are hardships that comes with seeking knowledge. Unless I have the patience to do so, then I won't move any further. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam, he says, "Man lam yasbir ala dhilli ta'allum," he who is not patient when it comes to the humbleness of seeking knowledge for 1 hour, baqiya fi dhilli jahli abada, he will remain in the humility of ignorance forever. So sometimes I need to learn to be as patient as I can. Otherwise, I will not learn anything. So that path of learning, obviously, is not easy. That's why we see a lot of people, when they try to learn, they fail and they move nowhere. Three, when it comes to the adequates of learning, is one, we say, لا حياء في العلم. There is no shame in trying to seek knowledge, or at least no embarrassment in trying to seek knowledge. Imam Rida alayhi salam, he says, لا يستحي أحدكم إذا لم يعلم أن يتعلم. He says, do not be embarrassed. Do not be ashamed that if you don't know, you go learn. And that's one of the biggest problems that we have these days. People who don't know, and they act as if they know.
Well, dear listeners, here we interrupt the normal course of our program and go live to the United Nations headquarters, where Iranian President Dr. Seyed Ebrahim Raisi is addressing the United Nations General Assembly. Let's take a listen.
پروردگارا درود و تحیات ما را به روان پاک پیامبران بزرگ.
Salutations to the pure souls of Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, peace upon them. که پیام عقلانیت, they convey the message of rationality, spirituality and morality to the world, and eliminated the foundations of ignorance so that human beings would be able to build a better world. Mr. Chairperson, ladies and gentlemen, the main criterion for building a better world is justice. All human causes will be surveyed based on justice. Rationality based on revelation believes in a major framework for justice. Justice means negating oppression. We are the flag bearers of justice. That rejects any sort of oppression, negates any sort of oppression, and the tendency to create, administer justice is a gift, a divine gift, and the accumulation of injustice will lead to movements by the peoples in the form of popular revolutions. Even though many movements have not reached the maturity of a revolution, and many revolutions have been diverted from their genuine path, but the success by certain nations, such as the Iranian nation, that is manifested in the continuation of the Islamic revolution, and that actually maintains the hope for justice and administration of justice amongst world people. The Islamic revolution is a manifestation of the Iranian nation's move towards justice. And despite various seditions, it has managed to defend and safeguard its causes. The Iranian nation, in the first, as the first step, has established the Islamic Republic, and in the second step is after the formation of a fair international order. The key elements in this path includes seeking God, raising awareness, humanitarian values, and multilateralism. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm honored to represent a nation that has inherited a legacy of a major civilization, a nation that has always been free and has for centuries foiled the moves by colonialists, a nation that considers oppression as a source of destruction and has also fought against the captivity of other nations. And that also includes the captivity of Palestinians. We believe in a common fate for humanity and do support globalization of justice. What we consider pleasant for ourselves, we do wish that for others, and whatever is unpleasant for us, we do not impose that on others. The Iranian nation is of the view that justice brings about unity and oppression causes the eruption of wars. A country that claims to seek justice within itself and at the same time breed terrorism outside and impose those terrorists in other nations, or through exerting various pressures, forcing other nations to give in. Such a government must be ashamed of humanity and freedom and justice. Humanity is not limited to certain humans, and human rights must observe the rights of all people. The Islamic Republic of Iran, inspired by religious values and its constitution, is one of the efficient mechanisms, enjoys one of the most efficient mechanisms for safeguarding human rights, and has made use of the most effective tools in order to restore the right of every individual. That's the responsibility, that's a divine obligation, that's the responsibility of the sovereignty, and it's a responsibility. The Islamic Republic of Iran considers double standard policies by certain governments as the main source of violation of human rights, and its outcome is various stances adopted towards a single event in the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the silence adopted towards the death of the massacre of several women in a Western country. And as long as such an approach exists, that will breach the human rights. And also, above human rights, you have the rights of nations. The rights of nations are being simply breached by oppressive governments and the rights of indigenous people in Canada. And then they have, the students have been buried in schools, and the Palestinian nation, their right to determine fate, and nations under sanctions, the right of nations under occupation or the countries that have fallen victim to terrorism, the right of displaced people, and see the children that are being kept in cages separate from their parents. These all indicate that, in fact, the position of the claimant and the defendant must not be changed with respect to human rights, and the violators of human rights are not in a position to express views about human rights. I can refer to the unique role of Iran in the elimination of Daesh, and the speaking of Kurdish.